a simpleton who had stupidly gone along with the others, sentenced to 7.5 years in prison. There are child molesters and murderers who serve less time. Eventually, the Clinton Department of Justice agreed with Pickering and requested a sentence of 2 years in prison. But the Democrats later seized on this case to accuse Pickering of being soft on cross-burners. Black Mississippians who knew Judge Pickering and had nothing to gain by defending him refused to go along with the smearing of the judge. On 60 Minutes, Charles Evers, brother of murdered civil rights leader Medgar Evers and a Pickering supporter, engaged in this exchange with the head of a local branch of the NAACP that was opposing Pickering. Charles Evers, "You know, maybe you don't know. You know that Charles Pickering is a man who helped us to break the Ku Klux Klan. Did you know that?" Clarence McGee, "I heard that statement made." Evers, "I mean, I know that. Do you know that?" McGee, "I don't know that." Evers, "I know that. Do you know about the young black man that was accused of robbing the young white woman? You know about that?" McGee, "Nope." Evers, "So Charles Pickering took the case, came to trial and won the case, and the young man became free." McGee, "I don't know about that." Evers, "But did you also know that Charles Pickering is the man who helped integrate his churches? You know about that?" McGee, "No." Evers, "Well, you don't know a thing about Charles Pickering." As 60 Minutes reported, Judge Pickering enjoys strong support from the many blacks who know him. In his hometown of Laurel, 4 of the 5 black city council members say they back him because of all he's done to improve race relations. And many black attorneys who practice before him say Pickering is fair and first rate. The Democrats' attack on Judge Pickering was nothing but a kiss-ass, spineless, contemptible suck-up to feminists on abortion. The day before Kerry won the Democrats' Best Fake Patriot contest in Iowa, he was on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos, calling Judge Pickering a cross-burning defending judge. It had been 24 hours since Kerry had sucked up to the feminists, so he had to get that out of the way by blackening Judge Pickering's name on national TV. While Kerry endlessly bragged on about his undaunted valor in Vietnam, it would have been nice if he had ever shown 1 ounce of courage by standing up to the feminists. The Democrats will sell out blacks, blue-collar workers, Catholics, Hispanics, and the elderly, but they will never cross Narrow. The most important thing isn't the little guy, the poor, the voiceless, civil rights, or the other America. The most important value to liberals is destroying human life. When a political party seeking votes from the American people views nothing as more sacred than ending human life, it has more to worry about than the risks of casual sex. Republicans aren't even sending in their A-team anymore, and the Democrats still can't win. The Democrats are being routed on every issue: gun control, national security, gay marriage, taxes, crime. The abortion ladies are the only ones still to be thrown off the boat. Republicans have won the battle of ideas on abortion, and now it's just a matter of time before the Supreme Court overturns Roe and allows Americans to vote. The death of Roe is going to be like the death of the Soviet Union, and not only because both events make liberals sad. Roe is already dead. We're just waiting for the official proclamation. Liberals think they can demand a ruling from the Supreme Court that will take all risk out of trysting sex. But the High Court can't do that any more than penicillin can. Liberals seem not to realize their real complaint is with a lawmaker whose judgment cannot be appealed. Chapter 5. Liberals' Doctrine of Infallibility. Sobbing, Hysterical Women. Liberals are perennially enraged that Republicans are allowed to talk back. For years, this wasn't a problem, because, in Lenin's immortal words, they had seized the telegraph office. There were only 3 TV stations, 3 major newspapers, and a handful of national magazines, all run by liberals. But at least since Rush Limbaugh got a microphone, liberals haven't been able to make arguments in a vacuum. The left's long-running monologue had become a dialogue, and they didn't like it one bit. So now they constantly try to recreate a world where they can hurl slander and treason without anyone arguing back. They needed a doctrine of infallibility. The appearance of Fox News Channel nearly drove liberals berserk. They were supposed to control 100% of news dissemination. When conservatives used to criticize the media, liberals always acted perplexed and indignant at the idea that a TV station could have a political bias. Then Fox News came along, and to listen to liberals, you'd think we were living in a police state. Fox News isn't even particularly conservative, though it is recognizably American. I believe the one verified atrocity committed by Fox News was the wearing of American flag lapel pins by some anchors after 9/11. Assuming, against all evidence, Fox News is every bit as conservative as CBS is liberal, it is still just a small beachhead in a universe of liberal speak. But the mere existence of one solitary network that doesn't toe the party line has driven the left insane. Liberals have made documentaries attacking Fox News, written books denouncing Fox News, screamed about lying liars on Fox News, and established websites to document the cruel deceptions of Fox News. The result of all this glandular hysteria is the 5 top-rated cable news shows are all on Fox News. Bill O'Reilly has more than 3 million viewers a night, while CNN viewers are measured in the hundreds of thousands and MSNBC by the occasional show of hands. Still, the establishment news shows on ABC and NBC have more than 10 million viewers apiece, yet another tribute to the overwhelming power of inertia. Even the fake news on CBS has more than 7 million viewers. Brit Hume gets a lousy 1 million viewers, and liberals think it's fascism in America. Inconsolable over the death of the old media, liberals told us that the nation was being torn apart by angry voices, polarizing rhetoric, angry white men, the politics of division. They said the nation has never been so divided, forgetting the somewhat polarized era America experienced between 1861 and 1865. Then people remembered the sweetness and light we got from liberals during, say, Watergate or the Bork hearings, when they had total control of the media. Liberals' idea of harmony is Democrats win everything all the time and no one else can talk. Next, Democrats tried explaining that they were being shellacked by the superior media savvy and rhetorical skills of Republicans, like that silver-tongued devil George W. Bush. They said their ideas were too complex to fit on a bumper sticker. This is crazy. I heart partial birth abortion fits quite easily. They said they just needed to retool their message, formulate winning sound bites, and talk about God's green earth, and maybe Democrats wouldn't keep frightening people. But the retooling didn't work. It turned out it really was the Democrats' message that Americans hated. Finally, the Democrats hit on an ingenious strategy. They would choose only messengers whom we're not allowed to reply to. That's why all Democratic spokesmen these days are sobbing, hysterical women. You can't respond to them because that would be questioning the authenticity of their suffering. Liberals haven't changed the message, just the messenger. All the most prominent liberal spokesmen are people with absolute moral authority. Democrats with a dead husband, a dead child, a wife who works at the CIA, a war record, a terminal illness, or, as a last resort, being on a first-name basis with Nelson Mandela. Like Oprah during Sweeps Week, liberals have come to rely exclusively on people with sad stories to improve their Q rating. They've become the lifetime TV network of political parties. Liberals prey on people at a time of extreme emotional vulnerability and offer them fame and fortune to be that month's purveyor of hate. Victory goes to the most hysterical. One way or another, the Bush administration was heartless for responding whenever it was attacked. It was cruel to respond to Cindy Sheehan, whose son died in Iraq, leading Cindy to become a rabid anti-war protester. Sheehan called Bush the biggest terrorist in the world, a Führer, an evil maniac, and a filth spewer. But, according to liberals, no one was allowed to sound a note of dissent because Sheehan lost a son in Iraq. It was treason to respond to Joe Wilson, who accused the Bush administration of lying about the case for war with Iraq based on Wilson's trip to Niger. Wilson called Bush a liar and Cheney a lying son of a bitch. But no one could say Wilson's alleged expertise was based on a nepotistic junket he was sent on because his wife worked at the CIA. Maureen Dowd of the New York Times made the point plainly by comparing Sheehan to Joe Wilson, saying, "The Bush team tried to discredit Mom, Sheehan, by pointing reporters to an old article in which she sounded kinder to W. If only her husband were an undercover CIA operative, the Bushies could out him." One wonders how exposing anything about Cindy could discredit her more than the poor imbecile's own words have. In addition to Sheehan and Wilson, over the last few years, the Democrats have used a grieving Carolyn McCarthy, whose husband was murdered by a lunatic on the Long Island Railroad, to lobby for gun control. A paralyzed, dying Christopher Reeve to argue for embryonic stem cell research. A gaggle of weeping widows to blame President Bush for 9/11. A disabled Vietnam veteran, Max Cleland, to attack the Iraq War and call Bush, Cheney, and every other human who ever disagreed with him a chicken hawk. A rare Democratic Purple Heart recipient, Congressman John Murtha, to argue for surrender in Iraq. In all these cases, Democrats took the position that the spokesperson immunized the message from criticism, no matter how vicious or insane it was. Former New Republic editor and gay marriage advocate Andrew Sullivan brandished the openly gay chaplain to New York City's firemen, who himself died at the World Trade Center on 9/11, in his ongoing nonstop argument for gay priests. The chaplain died on 9/11, therefore the Pope should back off. Democrats will even use our own people against us. After Democrats claimed Barry Goldwater was clinically insane when he was the Republican candidate for president, as soon as he went senile and started attacking the religious right, he became a conservative oracle for the media. Reagan aide James Brady was respected by liberals only after he was shot in the head by John Hinckley and became a spokesman for gun control groups. Back when Nancy Reagan was consulting an astrologer about Reagan's schedule after he was shot by Hinckley, liberals denounced her as a nut controlling the White House with a Ouija board. But after Reagan died of Alzheimer's disease and Nancy expressed support for embryonic stem cell research, liberals anointed her seer of technology. I can't think of a single example of conservatives doing this. far from trying to prevent liberals from responding, we enjoy watching liberals try to mount a counterargument, especially in the case of Cindy Sheehan, with that weird disconnect between the viciousness of her comments and her itsy-bitsy, squeaky voice. After 9/11, four housewives from New Jersey, whose husbands died in the attack on the World Trade Center, became media heroes for blaming their husbands' deaths on George Bush and demanding a commission to investigate why Bush didn't stop the attacks. Led by all-purpose scold Kristen Breitweiser, the four widows came to be known as the Jersey Girls. Original, adorable name, just four moms from New Jersey. The Jersey Girls weren't interested in national honor. They were interested in a lawsuit. They first came together to complain that the $1.6 million average settlement to be paid to 9/11 victims' families by the government was not large enough. After getting their payments jacked up, the weeping widows took to the airwaves to denounce George Bush, apparently for not beaming himself through space from Florida to New York and throwing himself in front of the second building at the World Trade Center. These self-obsessed women seemed genuinely unaware that 9/11 was an attack on our nation and acted as if the terrorist attacks happened only to them. The whole nation was wounded, all of our lives reduced. But they believed the entire country was required to marinate in their exquisite personal agony. Apparently, denouncing Bush was an important part of their closure process. These broads are millionaires, lionized on TV and in articles about them, reveling in their status as celebrities and stalked by grieferazzis. I've never seen people enjoying their husbands' deaths so much. The increasingly rabid widows demanded a commission to investigate why the FAA didn't realize, when it first received word about a hijacking, that this was part of a monstrous terrorist attack involving four commercial planes about to be turned into cruise missiles. On Donahue, Breitweiser said, "I'd like to know how our Pentagon, which is the home of our Defense Department, was hit an hour and 45 minutes after the air traffic controllers knew that they had airliners up that were hijacked. I don't understand how that's possible." It wasn't even an hour and 45 minutes between the first plane taking off from Logan Airport and the third plane crashing into the Pentagon. American Airlines Flight 11 took off at 7:59 a.m., so obviously, nobody knew at 7:59 that any planes were off course, much less about to attack the nation. Air traffic controllers in Boston first notified higher-ups that Flight 11 had been hijacked at 8:25. That plane crashed into the World Trade Center at 8:46, with F-15 fighter jets in hot pursuit. At 8:47 a.m., the FAA first received notice that United Airlines Flight 175 out of Boston was behaving abnormally. Minutes later, unbeknownst to the FAA, American Airlines Flight 77 was hijacked and diverted toward the Pentagon. At 9:03, Flight 175 crashed into the second World Trade Center building, at which point we knew the nation was under attack. Even after it was clear that an attack was underway, there was no way of knowing which of the thousands of other planes in U.S. airspace at the time, if any, was going to crash next, much less where such a crash might occur. The FAA grounded all domestic flights at 9:26 a.m., and at 9:37 a.m., American Airlines Flight 77 crashed into the Pentagon. The 9/11 Commission became the Jersey Girls' pet project. Breitweiser said, "We simply wanted to know why our husbands were killed and why they went to work one day and didn't come back." Oddly enough, swarthy Muslim beasts flew planes into our skyscrapers did not appear to be one of the possible answers. They demanded a commission to investigate, much as wives of the dead at Pearl Harbor demanded commissions to investigate FDR throughout World War II. We're already paying the salaries of 535 members of a standing bipartisan commission, which is called the U.S. Congress. But by establishing an independent commission, the Democrats were able to ensure a whitewash of Clinton's utter incompetence, cowardice, and capitulation to enemy regimes whose princes might be rich enough to write checks to the Clinton Presidential Library during the 8 years leading up to 9/11. The commission consisted of 5 members chosen by congressional Democrats, 4 members chosen by congressional Republicans, and the chairman chosen by President Bush. While the Republicans picked gutless moderate Republicans like Slade Gorton and Thomas Keene, Democrats named liberal attack dogs like Richard Benveniste, a former Watergate prosecutor who testified in defense of perjury and obstruction of justice during Clinton's impeachment hearings, and Jamie Gorelick, Clinton's deputy attorney general and the chief architect of the policies that prevented the FBI from unraveling the 9/11 plot before it happened. That's bipartisan in Washington. This would be like a commission on henhouse management, with the Republicans carefully choosing well-credentialed hens and the Democrats sending in bloodthirsty foxes. During the commission's investigation, Clinton's former national security advisor, Sandy Berger, was caught secreting Clinton-era documents out of the National Archives by stuffing them in his pants and socks. Leave it to a Clinton lackey like Berger to turn a probe of the worst terrorist attack in history into an episode of Get Smart. Sandy Burglar later pleaded guilty and was sentenced to community service and ordered to pay more than $50,000. The Democrats treated the 9/11 Commission as one more battlefield in their ongoing war with Republicans, while bewildered Republicans looked on helplessly. For Democrats, everything is political. Coretta Scott King's funeral, Paul Wellstone's memorial, a Dixie Chicks concert. They will turn a major national disaster like a hurricane breaking the levees in New Orleans into a political football. Republicans demanded that President Richard Nixon resign for one lie. Democrats went to war to defend President Clinton for a mountain of lies and felonies, with not one Democrat voting to remove Clinton from office. Even the Supreme Court was shocked by this. In a breathtaking rebuke, not a single justice attended Clinton's next State of the Union address, not even the justices Clinton had appointed. Speaking of which, when a Democrat is in the White House, Republican senators vote by huge majorities to confirm extreme left-wing lawyers to the Supreme Court, such as former ACLU lawyer Ruth Bader Ginsburg. When a Republican is president, Democratic senators turn every Supreme Court nomination, even lower court appointments, into Armageddon. Conforming to pattern, when a commission was convened to investigate intelligence failures that preceded 9/11, Republicans mistakenly imagined that the purpose of the commission was to investigate intelligence failures, not to be a partisan game for the Democrats to rewrite history. The only valuable information about government failures leading to 9/11 has come out in the press, not the commission report. The Clinton Whitewash Commission covered up a classified military data mining project known as Able Danger, for example. The Able Danger intelligence operation was said to have identified Mohammed Atta, the leader of the 9/11 attack, and perhaps 3 other hijackers more than a year before the attack. In other words, back when you-know-who was president. The commission completely ignored this stunning information, almost as if they were trying to cover something up. When the media got wind of Abel Danger, long after the commission had completed its report, the Democratic co-chairman of the commission, Lee Hamilton, denied that they had heard anything about Abel Danger. The 9/11 commission, Hamilton said, did not learn of any U.S. government knowledge prior to 9/11 of surveillance of Mohammed Atta or of his cell. Had we learned of it, obviously it would have been a major focus of our investigation. A day or two later, Hamilton changed his story, admitting the commission had been told about Abel Danger, but claimed they didn't mention it in their report because it was not historically significant. This time, the word obviously was conspicuously absent from his prepared statement. Abel Danger wasn't historically significant in the sense that the intelligence gathered by this operation did not stop the 9/11 attack. It could not have prevented the attack because the information produced by Abel Danger was destroyed by the Clinton administration. So, on Hamilton's theory, the only way for Abel Danger to have been historically significant is if the intelligence had prevented the attack, in which case there would have been no need for a 9/11 commission. I think that's what the commission was supposed to be looking for. The commission report was also short on information about the policy instituted by Clinton's Deputy Attorney General, Jamie Gorelick, which is odd, since she was sitting right there on the commission, thanks to the Democrats. Gorelick had specifically prohibited intelligence agents from telling law enforcement agents about suspected terrorists in the country. Gorelick issued guidelines that, according to the words she wrote, go beyond what is legally required. She said she erected the wall in order to be absolutely sure that any intelligence information gathered would be admissible at a later criminal trial. As terrorism prosecutor Andrew McCarthy says, the object of a rational counterterrorism approach is to prevent mass murder from happening in the first place, not to improve your litigating posture for the indictment you return after thousands of people have been slaughtered. Apart from the Great Wall of China, the wall separating intelligence gathering from law enforcement is the only man-made structure on Earth visible to space aliens. Back when Clinton was protecting the nation with the able assistance of his Deputy Attorney General, Jamie Gorelick, prosecutors and FBI agents were screaming from the rooftops that Gorelick's wall of separation between intelligence and law enforcement would lead to dead Americans. Mary Jo White, the Clinton-appointed U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, wrote a letter directly to Gorelick, warning, "The single biggest mistake we can make in attempting to combat terrorism is to insulate the criminal side of the house from the intelligence side of the house, unless such insulation is absolutely necessary." White continued, "Excessive conservatism can have deadly results." The commission received a copy of this letter to Gorelick, but curiously did not see fit to include it in the final report. Then Attorney General John Ashcroft told the commission that the wall had prevented FBI agents from even being told 9/11 hijackers Nawaf al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Midar were in the country until weeks before the attack. So, 3,000 Americans are dead, but we can all rest easy. Nawaf and Khalid's constitutional rights had been secured the day they flew a plane into the Pentagon. Ashcroft read a letter from an FBI agent to headquarters, angrily remarking that the Gorelick guidelines were giving the most protection to Osama bin Laden. FBI headquarters responded, "We're all frustrated with this issue. These are the rules. The FBI's National Security Law Unit does not make them up. But somebody did make these rules. Somebody built this wall. And the somebody who built the wall was a 9/11 commissioner chosen by the Democrats. Apart from the Wright brothers' invention of the airplane itself, no single innovation was more responsible for the 9/11 attacks than Gorelick's decision to put up this wall. And yet, Gorelick was never called upon to explain why department guidelines ever should have gone beyond what the literally suicidal law required. The 9/11 Commission report barely mentioned the wall. Perhaps it, too, was deemed historically insignificant. Instead of calling Gorelick as a witness, the 9/11 Commission wasted the time of current administration officials in the middle of a war demanding that they testify to well-known events. The 9/11 Commission was a scam and a fraud, the sole purpose of which was to cover up the disasters of the Clinton administration and distract the nation's leaders during wartime. Not only did the Jersey girls claim credit for this Clinton whitewash machine, they spent most of the hearings denouncing the Bush administration for not stopping the 9/11 attack from the weak position handed it by the Clinton administration. Specific policies of the Clinton administration were all but designed to ensure that the 9/11 attacks could not be stopped. Just four moms from New Jersey were satisfied knowing that Clinton felt their pain. That was all that mattered. In an interview with Deborah Norville about Condoleezza Rice's testimony before the 9/11 Commission, Jersey girl Breitweiser complained, "Really? She spent the day just saying that, no, I didn't do anything wrong. No one asked me to do this. How would I know?" In the same interview, Jersey girl Patty Casazza demanded to know why Rice didn't stop the attack on the basis of the now-famous August 6th PDB, or Presidential Daily Briefing. Casazza said the August PDB certainly stated that Osama bin Laden was all set to do an attack on the homeland here in the United States. And, with that information, I don't know how you wouldn't have, you know, put up a better defense. If this PDB was so important, why has the media shied away from printing it? The New York Times never had room, just one day, to print the entire PDB. All you ever hear about is the title, Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S., Midwest Girl Determined to Succeed in Hollywood. In fact, the full PDB is a Cliff's Notes history lesson on Al-Qaeda. It reads like a homework assignment that should have been done earlier but wasn't, and instead got quickly cobbled together at midnight by hitting the encyclopedia. Bin Laden prepares operations years in advance and is not deterred by setbacks. And there you have it, the entire 9/11 plot. Indeed, all the information about Bin Laden in the August PDB comes from the 90s. Not one fact in the PDB is more recent than 1999. Thus, for example, the memo recites these facts. Bin Laden, since 1977, has wanted to conduct terrorist attacks in the U.S. The Millennium Plotting in Canada in 1999 may have been part of Bin Laden's first serious attempt to implement a terrorist strike in the U.S. Two Al-Qaeda members, found guilty in the conspiracy to bomb our embassies in East Africa, were U.S. citizens, and a senior EIJ, Egyptian Islamic Jihad, member lived in California in the mid-1990s. While the PDB had a lot of old news about bin Laden, it didn't have much to say about his future plans. Even if the memo's stale information had been recast in the form of urgent warnings rather than as factual data from a boring book report, the PDB did not predict one single fact about the 9/11 attack. There is nothing in the memo that could possibly have prevented 9/11. The four statements in the PDB hinting at al-Qaeda's future operations were these. CIA and the FBI are investigating a call to our embassy in UAE in May, saying that a group of bin Laden supporters was in the U.S. planning attack with explosives. The 9/11 attack did not involve explosives. We have not been able to corroborate some of the more sensational threat reporting, such as that from a redacted service in 1998, saying that bin Laden wanted to hijack a U.S. aircraft to gain the release of blind Sheikh Umar Abd al-Rahman and other U.S.-held extremists. The 9/11 attack was not an attempt to ransom the blind Sheikh or any other Muslim terrorists, which would have required taking live hostages, not just killing a lot of people by crashing the planes. FBI information since that time indicates patterns of suspicious activity in the country, consistent with preparations for hijackings or other types of attacks, including recent surveillance of federal buildings in New York. The 9/11 attack did not target any federal buildings in New York. A clandestine source said in 1998 that a bin Laden cell in New York was recruiting Muslim American youth for attacks. None of the 19 hijackers were youths recruited from a bin Laden cell in New York. If the entire federal government had gone on red alert in response to the August 6th PDB, FBI agents would have been rousting suspected terrorists in Queens and looking for swarthy men in U-Haul trucks outside the federal courthouse in New York. In theory, they might also have instituted racial profiling at airport security, which would have prevented both the hostage taking mentioned in the August PDB and the actual 9/11 attack. Liberals won't let us do this after 9/11. They certainly wouldn't have let us do it before 9/11. So besides a general historical review of al-Qaeda, noun, Arabic for the base, terrorist group formed in 1980s that seeks to attack the U.S., based on information known since at least 1999, the few bits of information about future attacks contained nothing of relevance to the actual attack. Why didn't the media ever see fit to reveal the full text of the August 6th PDB? It's not as if this memo wasn't being used to bash the administration. The media deliberately prevented Americans from seeing the memo in order to attack Condoleezza Rice for saying the document contained only historical information, which it did. Of course, there were clues about what the famous PDB contained. When Richard Benveniste interrogated Condoleezza Rice about the PDB during the 9/11 commission hearings, wasting the time of the president's national security advisor in wartime, he nearly had to pull out a bullhorn to prevent Rice from revealing its contents. Benveniste, isn't it a fact, Dr. Rice, that the August 6th PDB warned against possible attacks in this country? And I ask you whether you recall the title of that PDB. Rice, I believe the title was Bin Laden Determined to Attack Inside the United States. Now the Benveniste, thank you. Rice, no, Mr. Benveniste, you, Benveniste, I will get into the, Rice, I would like to finish my point here. Benveniste, I didn't know there was a point. I asked you what the title was. Rice, you asked me whether or not it warned of attacks. Benveniste, I asked you what the title was. Rice, you said, did it not warn of attacks? It did not warn of attacks inside the United States. It was historical information based on old reporting. There was no new threat information, and it did not, in fact, warn of any coming attacks inside the United States. This enraged the Jersey girls. How dare Rice deny that the 9/11 plot had been laid out plainly in a document that issued such clarion warnings as, "Bin Laden associates surveyed our embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam as early as 1993, and some members of the Nairobi cell planning the bombing were arrested and deported in 1997. Obviously, this meant 19 Muslim men were going to wrest control of 4 commercial aircraft flying out of Boston's Logan Airport, Washington's Dulles Airport, and New Jersey's Newark Airport on the morning of September 11 and fly the planes into the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and a field in Pennsylvania. Why wouldn't Rice admit she could have stopped the 9/11 attack and saved Kristen Breitweiser's husband? Mostly, the witches of East Brunswick wanted George Bush to apologize for not being Bill Clinton. Like Monica Lewinsky before her, Breitweiser found impeached President Clinton very forthcoming. She also found the flamboyant Bush basher Richard Clark very forthcoming. Miss Va-Va-Voom of 1968 seemed to think the 9/11 Commission was her nationally televised personal therapy session, and as long as government officials issued fake apologies, she could have closure. One shudders to imagine how Clinton ministers to 4 widows. The rest of the nation was more interested in knowing why the FBI was prevented from being given intelligence about 9/11 terrorists here in the United States more than a year before the attack, and would have liked to have top government officials back on the job preventing the next terrorist attack rather than participating in a charade intended to exonerate the Clinton administration. Needless to say, the Democrat Rat Pack gals endorsed John Kerry for president. Most audaciously, they complained about the Bush campaign using images from the 9/11 attack in campaign ads, calling it political propaganda, which was completely different from the just 4 moms from Jersey cutting campaign commercials for Kerry. And by the way, how do we know their husbands weren't planning to divorce these harpies? Now that their shelf life is dwindling, they'd better hurry up and appear in Playboy. Other weeping widows began issuing rules about what could be done at Ground Zero in New York City. This is among the contributing factors to the fact that it's been 5 years since the 9/11 attack, and Ground Zero is still just a big empty plot of ground in the most dynamic city in the world. 5 years after Pearl Harbor, we had won World War II, fielded armies on 2 continents, and developed the atom bomb. Construction workers cleaned up the entire World Trade Center site, 1.8 million tons of rubble, 16 acres wide, 7 stories high, and 70 feet below ground, months ahead of schedule. But since then, the site has remained unchanged, while family members squabble about what may be built on the sacred ground. "You have to shut down the number 1 train because it reminds me of my husband." If FDR had had to put up with this, no planes would ever have been allowed to fly over Hawaii again. Surely, there can be a proper memorial without leaving the footprints empty. The British burned the Capitol and the White House in the War of 1812. If we'd been smart, those are the places we would have left empty. A lot of widows support Bush. A lot support Pat Buchanan. But they were not trying to convert their personal tragedy into a weapon to dictate national policy or redesign Lower Manhattan. None of the weeping widows issuing demands, I note, were firemen's wives. And how about we hear from some wives of proud fighting Marines? While these professional 9/11 victims turned themselves into the arbiters of what anyone could say about 9/11, Some poor woman in Astoria, Queens, was being told her husband died in a car accident. She won't be paid millions of dollars, feted in Vanity Fair, or granted federal commissions to investigate why her husband died. It's especially odd having the angry 9/11 widows fawned over by the same political party that objects to crime victims delivering victim impact statements. From now on, when someone's loved one is killed by a criminal and given a reduced sentence by a liberal judge, can that judge be hauled before a committee of the family? Another Democrat who used a tragedy that befell a mate to end an argument was the biggest drama queen of them all, Joseph C. Wilson IV. Wilson is the ne'er-do-well, unemployed WASP who claimed to be a Bush insider, accusing the president of lying about pre-war intelligence on Iraq. Wilson's prior work experience consisted of drifting through some low-level positions at U.S. embassies over the years until reaching the pinnacle of his career, ambassador to Gabon. Wilson insists on being called ambassador. Wilson thrust himself on the nation in July 2003. He wrote an op-ed for the New York Times claiming Bush had lied in his State of the Union address when he said the famous 16 words. The British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa. The British believed it then and believe it now. A bipartisan Senate committee that conducted a painstaking investigation believes it. Why, even the French believe it. After coalition forces conquered Iraq in 17 days flat, with amazingly few casualties, forcing liberals to carp about something other than the execution of the war, they became hysterical about the case for war. Consequently, the British government convened the Butler Commission to evaluate their government's pre-war intelligence. Among the commission's conclusions released in 2004 was this: it is accepted by all parties that Iraqi officials visited Niger in 1999 and that the British government had intelligence from several different sources indicating that this visit was for the purpose of acquiring uranium. But that's not how Wilson saw it. In 2002, he had been sent on an unpaid government make-work job to Niger to investigate whether Saddam Hussein had tried to buy uranium ore from Niger. Wilson's method of investigating consisted of sitting around cafes asking African potentates questions like, "Did you commit a horrible crime which, if so, would ruin your country's relationship with the United States? I have no independent means of corroborating this, so be honest." It seems not to have occurred to Wilson that his method of investigation might not be watertight. But on the basis of the answers he got, Wilson concluded that Saddam had not sought uranium ore from Niger. The Senate Intelligence Committee later learned that Wilson's trip had unwittingly bolstered the case that Saddam had sought uranium from Niger. Joe Wilson seems to go through life doing things unwittingly. Almost as an afterthought, Wilson had informed CIA employees that the former prime minister of Niger told him an Iraqi delegation had proposed expanding commercial relations with Niger. Since Niger's only major export is uranium, anyone who discusses expanding commercial relations with Niger is talking about buying uranium. But Wilson was floored when he heard Bush's State of the Union address. Listening to Bush's speech, Wilson interpreted Africa to mean Niger and British intelligence to mean Joseph Wilson, and realized in horror that Bush must have been referring to Wilson's very own report. Or at least that's what he realized soon after he started working for the Kerry campaign in May 2003. This was a fact that the media seemed studiously uninterested in pursuing. Wilson's inadvertent admission that he had begun advising the Kerry campaign 1 month before he started making his outlandish claims against the Bush administration. In October 2003, the Associated Press reported that Wilson said he had been advising Kerry on foreign policy for about 5 months. That means he started working for Kerry in May 2003, a month before he wrote his New York Times op-ed titled, "What I Didn't Find in Africa." Out of love for his country and an insatiable desire to have someone notice his worthless existence, Wilson wrote a column for the Times that called Bush a liar. His story was nutty enough to be believed by the entire New York Times editorial board. Though Wilson's defenders later indignantly denied it, he had clearly implied in his op-ed that he had been sent to Niger at the behest of Vice President Dick Cheney and had reported back to him, which was certainly news to Cheney. Among Wilson's other references to the high-level nature of his trip, in his J'accuse column in the Times, he said, "I was informed by officials at the Central Intelligence Agency that Vice President Dick Cheney's office had questions about a particular intelligence report. Agency officials asked if I would travel to Niger to check out the story so they could provide a response to the Vice President's office." Curiously, one agency official also asked him to take out the trash and be home early for Junior's T-ball game that night. "Based on my experience with the administration in the months leading up to the war, I have little choice but to conclude that some of the intelligence related to Iraq's nuclear weapons program was twisted to exaggerate the Iraqi threat." He neglected to mention that his experience with the Bush administration was limited to what he read in the Washington Post from his living room couch. True, Wilson never unequivocally stated that Cheney sent him to Niger or that he reported back to Cheney, but he sure as hell didn't say his wife had recommended him for the trip. With Wilson's encouragement, soon the entire press corps was reporting that Cheney had sent him to Niger and that Wilson's non-existent files were sitting on Cheney's desk. In short order, the White House was being forced to deny that the vice president had sent Wilson to Niger. CNN's White House correspondent Dana Bash querulously remarked that the White House at this time was continuing to deny that Cheney had ordered Wilson to make the trip. Now, with regard to Ambassador Wilson's charge that it was actually the vice president's office that ordered him to go and that they did know about his conclusion, administration officials are, at this time, flatly denying that. One official is telling CNN, quote, that they were, quote, unaware of the mission and unaware of the results or conclusion of his mission. So this is something that the White House is continuing to deny. ABC News reported, in a program objectively titled, "Bush Administration Deceives America. President Used Known Falsehood to Lead Americans to War," that Ambassador Joe Wilson says, at the request of Vice President Cheney's office, the CIA sent him to Niger in February 2002. Wilson not only failed to correct the media's mammoth misunderstanding about the genesis of his trip to Niger, but began claiming that the vice president was aware of his conclusions. On Meet the Press, Wilson said, "The office of the vice president, I am absolutely convinced, received a very specific response to the question it asked, and that response was based upon my trip out there." Unless he was referring to the vice president of the Screen Actors Guild, this was preposterous. But Wilson assured the Washington Post, based on his insider knowledge, no doubt, When you task a serious organization like the CIA to answer a question, it doesn't go into a black hole. It might go into a black hole, however, if you were sent by your wife. The Washington Post reported that the Bush administration and British government had ignored Wilson's findings that helped debunk claims that Iraq had tried to obtain uranium from Niger. This was about the same time the Bush administration ignored my report that I was running low on dishwasher detergent. The union leader, Manchester, New Hampshire, reported that Wilson went to Niger at the request of Vice President Richard Cheney's office, and that Wilson said he had files with the State Department, CIA, and the Vice President's office saying there were no uranium sales to Iraq. Wilson had filed no written report, but suddenly his files were sitting on the Vice President's desk. The Daily Telegraph, London, went the whole nine yards, calling Wilson a CIA man and a senior CIA envoy sent to investigate the claim about Saddam seeking uranium. Wilson was finally breaking his silence after being sent to Niger on CIA orders, that is, by his wife. According to the Telegraph, Mr. Wilson said he believed that his conclusions would have been automatically shared with British officials. So now, Wilson's non-existent report was not only on Cheney's desk, but had been wired to Tony Blair. Los Angeles Times columnist Robert Scheer called Wilson the mysterious envoy sent to Niger under pressure from Cheney, and claimed Wilson reported back the facts to Cheney. And the Democrats' leading geopolitical strategist, Bianca Jagger, said, "Ambassador Joseph Wilson said his report got to the State Department, to the White House, to the National Security, and that he believes that all of them should have that information and that Vice President Cheney should have had that information." So don't tell me it wasn't relevant that Wilson had been recommended for the unpaid trip to Niger by his wife. Soon, journalist Robert Novak revealed in his July 14, 2003 syndicated column that Wilson did not go to Niger on a high-level CIA mission for Vice President Cheney, as Wilson had implied. Wilson spoke with no expertise. He was not a CIA man. He was not sent by Dick Cheney. No one in the White House was ever told of Wilson's make-work report. He had been sent by his wife, Valerie Plame, a chair warmer at the CIA who apparently wanted to get him out of the house. Wilson had never even filed any written report, but gave an oral report to a few CIA bureaucrats who came to his house just before Wilson zoomed back to his Austin Powers fantasy camp. In response to Novak's column, Wilson accused Karl Rove of outing his wife as an undercover spy to get her killed and retaliate against him. In the words of the Washington Post, Wilson believed his wife had been mentioned to intimidate other government insiders from talking to journalists, except Wilson wasn't an insider and his wife wasn't an undercover spy. Liberals were allowed to boast that Wilson was sent by the CIA and reported back to Cheney. But in the traditional liberal definition of criminal, Republicans were committing heinous crimes if they responded by pointing out that Wilson's trip was a boondoggle arranged by his wife. The man the Democrats wanted to be commander-in-chief, Senator John Kerry, said, "It's an act of treason to reveal the identity of intelligence sources." Not as treasonous as calling your comrades-in-arms war criminals during the Vietnam War, but still a pretty serious offense. A sampling of headlines from various newspapers indicates the tenor of the coverage. "So now we sell out our own?" Santa Fe, New Mexican. August 3, 2003. Blowing CIA agents' cover weakens national security. Atlanta Journal-Constitution, September 30, 2003. Bush administration must bring rogue officials to justice. CIA agent outed for partisan political reasons. News Tribune, Tacoma, Washington, October 1, 2003. Editorial, Betrayal of Trust, Denver Post, October 2, 2003. CIA leak, loose-lipped leak, The Sunday Oregonian, October 5, 2003. Dirty and Deadly, Charleston Gazette, West Virginia, October 26, 2003. Defiant Novak should be indicted, tried for treason. Palm Beach Post, Florida, October 27, 2003. Noticeably, none of the newspapers screaming about treason or traitors were papers like the Washington Post. For the really insane stuff, you have to go to Bush League newspapers, where reporters have all the venom of the big city newspapers combined with retard-level IQs. The real story about Joseph C. Wilson IV was not Bush lied, kids died. It was that Wilson and his wife foisted their mutual fantasies on the nation, instigating massive investigations, the only provable conclusion of which is that Joe Wilson is a nut and a liar. CIA man Wilson's diplomatic career was a joke. Back when he had a job, Wilson was the guy who made sure the toilets at American embassies flushed and the commissary was stocked in such desirable locations as Niger, Togo, South Africa, Burundi, and Iraq. His big break came when Saddam waited for the U.S. ambassador to leave Iraq on vacation before invading Kuwait, leaving only Deputy Chief of the U.S. Mission Wilson behind. The fact that Wilson had no training in Middle East affairs and did not speak Arabic was no impediment to his post in Iraq because, as the New York Times put it at the time, he has risen within the Foreign Service as an administrative officer, someone usually more concerned that the embassy heating and plumbing work than with what is going on in the host country. As President Bush, 41, prepared for war, he repeatedly dissed Saddam by telling him to talk to Wilson, which, in diplomatic circles, is considered one step above talk to the hand. Wilson's major assignment during that period was to set up a meeting between Saddam and an actual official from the Bush administration, James Baker. People who do that sort of thing are usually called secretaries, not Mr. Ambassador. One of Wilson's friends boasted of Wilson's qualifications to the Associated Press. He's certainly capable to make any message, which is so unfair. Joe also made really good coffee. Secretary of State James Baker sent Wilson a pro forma letter conveying Bush's message that Wilson's work was truly inspiring and telling him to keep fighting the good fight. Also, we hope we can count on your vote in the next election. Wilson instantly began brandishing the letter to reporters. He even shared his fantasy obituary with reporters, saying it would read, "Joseph C. Wilson IV, who was the last American diplomat to meet with Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, died." Conceitedly, this was better than Joseph C. Wilson IV, mostly unemployed his entire life, briefly had a paying job unstopping toilets at American embassies in Togo and Burundi. A 1990 New York Times article on the message boy left behind in Iraq quoted Wilson reminiscing about the last time he had faced down his own mortality and making dramatic